ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is an RNZ podcast.
Hello?
Piki mai, kake mai, and a very big welcome to Our Changing World. Ko Alison Balance aho. It's great to be back with a whole lot of new stories for 2019. Later on tonight, I'll catch you up with what's been happening in the kakapo world, and I can tell you, it's a lot. But first, fish ear bones. Fish ear bones may be small, but when I visit Niwa scientist Emma Egan in her Hamilton lab, she tells me they're a treasure trove of information and a surprisingly detailed record of a fish's life.
I study fish ear bones, also called otoliths. That's the scientific name for them. And otoliths are calcium carbonate structures that are located in the inner ear of fish.
So we don't have them.
We don't have otoliths, but we have ears. Yeah. And they kind of actually have a similar function, because ear bones help fish to maintain balance and to detect vibrations around them. So they kind of help them with their movement. But there's actually a lot more information contained in these otoliths or calcium carbonate structures.
All fish have them?
Yes, all fish have them, and they come in all different shapes and all different sizes, and they're actually really beautiful. People make jewellery out of them. They attach them to earrings and necklaces. They're kind of white, little pearly structures, quite attractive.
Have you got one you can show me?
I do, yeah, and I have a couple of species here I can show you.
Those are ear bones that are all stuck down that sheet of paper.
Yeah, so these are longfin eels, actually, from Lake Hawea, and they're all female eels. So when we extract the ear bones to keep them safe until we go and analyse them, they get stuck to a black piece of paper. So you can see here they have, you know, all quite different shapes and sizes, and there's some serrations around here.
And so they're about, what, 3 mils long?
3 mils maximum length.
Maximum,
yeah. But we, normally they're about 1 millimetre.
And very irregularly shaped, but they're all eel ones.
These are all eels, yeah. And I'll just show you some flounder. So flounder are actually very different structure altogether.
Describe these ones to me.
Very serrated edges, and you can actually see a very distinct white core. And that transparent ring that you can see is most likely the first annual ring, so the first year of growth in a flounder.
They look almost like miniature limpet shells.
Yeah, they do look like limpets, yeah. But they're quite serrated, you can see in the edges. And as a fish grows, the structure of the otolith becomes more complex. And they lay down calcium carbonate every day onto this structure. And it's because of this, the daily deposition onto the otolith, we can extract information about a fish every single day of its life.
So it's almost creating rings like a tree ring?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the technique and the method I'm exploiting for eels. So basically, if you cut an eel ear bone in half and burn it to enhance the annual rings, they have a similar structure to what you see in trees, where you can see a ring laid down every single year.
And burning it just makes those rings stand out.
Yeah, it enhances it, because the annual ring represents a period of slow growth in a fish, and it has a different chemical structure to the otolith material that is deposited in the summer. So the annual ring is also called a winter ring sometimes, and it turns brown or black by burning because it has a different chemical structure in that. That's what we use to help us and guide us in the ageing process and to be able to see the rings a little bit clearer.
So these data sheets you've got here look quite old. So where are they from?
Some of these are from one of the first studies on eels in New Zealand on ageing, and they were done by a man called Peter Todd, and he used to work for Niwa's predecessors. And these ear bones were collected in 1975, 76, 77. So some of these fish are up to 20 years of age. So basically, by examining these old ear bones, we have a record of growth in Lake Ellesmere back to the 1950s. So what I'm trying to do is to understand how eel growth rates have changed through time in Te Waihora, Lake Ellesmere, and if there is an effect of climate change on eel growth rates. So I've generated a time series basically of 50 years almost, which is probably one of the longest time series of freshwater fish growth in New Zealand.
So how do you make a time series? You've got all these individual otoliths.
Yeah. So basically you start from the outer edge of the ear bone and you count every single annual ring.
Just like tree rings.
Just like tree rings. And you know the year you caught the fish. So you can assign every ring a year at formation. So, for example, these eels were caught in the Waitaki in 2004, and I know that the last ring was formed in 2003, 2002, 2001, and you work progressively into the central part of the ear bone. So for every individual fish, you basically are creating a time series of growth, and then you stitch all of your fish together that have shared growth in the same year to make an even longer time series. So for Lake Ellesmere, like I said, it dates from 1952 to 2013. And then what we do is we extract climate information. So information on El Niños and La Niña cycles, on the southern annular mode, temperature, the interdecadal Pacific oscillation. And we use those environmental variables and statistically model eel growth rates with those variables to see if they're responding to climate change.
So it might be that in a good year that the growth ring is wider because they had a good year. Next year might be colder, it's narrower. Does it work like that?
Exactly, and the good growth year might correspond to an extreme event like an El Niño or a La Niña or a regime shift in the interdecadal Pacific oscillation. Wind, if you think back in 1968, there was the Wahine storm in Lake Ellesmere, which resulted in the macrophytes being torn out of the system, and the lake actually changed state, and it was very windy as a result of that storm. And that is a very distinct disturbance event in the storm. And what's really amazing is that by reconstructing growth from all of these old collections, we can pick up some signatures of the effects of that storm on eel growth rates. And we can see basically from our statistical models that they are responding to how variable wind was over that time period, which we think represents the Wahine storm. And likewise, we also have picked up signatures of El Niño events in 97, 98. There was an extreme El Niño event that year, and actually that resulted in lower growth rates of short fin eels in Lake Ellesmere. And I guess we don't know how eels are responding throughout the country. This is just one location that we have had an ability to collect data from multiple people. There's a lot of Niwa scientists that have worked on eels, like Don Jellyman, Shan Crow, Mike Benchies, Peter Todd. So I've just kind of collected all of those ear bones and reused them. So we don't know how short fins or long fins are responding in different parts of the country. Of course, climate change has different effects depending on whether you're in the North or South Island, West or East Coast, rivers, lakes, you know, that kind of a thing. So this is kind of just the first step towards getting to grips about how eels might be responding to climate change.
So you can plug in the trends that you're seeing from the past into future models of what might happen with them?
Yes, potentially. We do need to get a much better understanding of what affects annual growth rate in eels. Of course, they are part of a fishery in New Zealand, and fishing can have impacts on eel growth rates. That is something we haven't analysed yet in our model, how fishing activity might change eel growth rates in conjunction with environmental change due to climate change. So I guess we need to get a better handle of all of the impacts on eel growth rates before we can start to make projections into the future. But it's definitely possible. They do it for marine species where they have a much kind of in-depth understanding of their biology and ecology. But for now, we're kind of taking baby steps at the minute. You know, this is one of the first studies of this extent, I guess, in New Zealand. And we're just kind of processing it and, you know, deciding where to go next.
Tell me a bit more about the ring that's right in the middle, the first one they lay down.
So that actual, the dark centre in the eel ear bone represents its larval phase when it was at sea. So
they breed somewhere?
Yeah, in the Western Pacific Ocean. We're not 100% sure yet. My colleagues actually at NIWA are going to be tagging migrating long fin eels with pop-up satellite tags. And, of course, we have never really been able to locate where longfins spawn. Don Jellyman is the scientist that has worked a lot on this aspect of the eel life cycle. And it's, you know, considered the holy grail among eel scientists in the world, because a lot of other eels we have managed to find their spawning grounds, but for the longfin eel, it's still the biggest question. So, yeah, a group of my colleagues next April are tagging longfins to try and find where they spawn. So that will give us a little bit more information about where exactly in the Pacific Ocean they might spawn. For shortfin eels, we have a little bit of a better understanding. Through tagging studies, and also some Japanese colleagues have actually found the shortfin larvae in the Western Pacific Ocean, newly hatched ones. And the larvae are called leptocephali. So we do have some kind of an idea of where they might be located. But we're not sure if long fins and short fins have different spawning grounds. Do they change over the spawning season? Do they change between years? So those are all really big questions that we need to answer. And actually, there's a lot of information contained in the core of the otolith that represents the larval phase. So during that phase, there's daily ring deposition, not annual. So you can basically get an insight into the daily life of a larval eel as it's transported from its spawning grounds in the Western Pacific to New Zealand's coastline. And also, as they are moving through the marine environment, they're picking up the chemical signature of that marine environment, and that's all recorded in this tiny, tiny ear bone. And we actually have just launched a project where we're hoping to investigate the larval life of eels, of both shortfin and longfin, looking at the daily rings, looking at the chemistry. We're also going to be looking at the isotopes of the tissue of glass eels as they come into New Zealand, and using a technique called compound-specific stable isotopes of amino acids. Quite fancy, bit of a mouthful. But it's a very novel way that we're hoping can help us to assign their potential origins and where they came from in their spawning area. And it's quite nice because it complements some of the tagging work. The tagging work is looking at where the adults go to in the Western Pacific. And our question is, where do the babies come from? So it's actually really nice complementary research that we're doing. There has been some work done on the daily rings of the glass eels, and a little bit of work on the chemistry, again by Don Jellyman and co. But this time we are trying to get a much more holistic understanding by using the chemistry over its entire life, as well as the fancy stable isotope analysis, as well as the microstructure from different parts of the country that are influenced by different oceanographic currents, to try and answer the questions: are they coming from different spawning grounds, and are they using different dispersal currents and dispersal routes to come to New Zealand? There's so much information in the ear bone. They're like diaries, you know. They're really, really fascinating structures. They're a treasure trove, really, and by using multiple techniques together, you can start to get a much kind of bigger and holistic picture and understanding. And look, if we don't answer these questions, I'm not going to shed tears, because it's all new information, it's all new science, and it's just going to, you know, progress and advance the field even more and give us a better understanding of the larval marine life of our shortfin and longfin eels.
And maybe help solve part of the mystery.
Yeah, maybe. That would be amazing. And also, it's really important research from the perspective that where their spawning grounds are located is an area that is rapidly undergoing the effects of climate change and sea level rise and ocean acidification and increasing temperatures. So in order for us to get a better understanding of the recruitment of glass eels to New Zealand, we need to start to understand the larval marine phase. And, you know, this is very much like our white bait, where they also spend a part of their life in the sea. And it's a very difficult period in their life to study. They're little tiny fish out in a big, massive ocean. And that's why you can't tag them, because they're tiny. You know, it's very expensive to do a research cruise, and you might not be very successful at finding them. So that's why the ear bone is like the most critical tool available to us to help understand the larval phase of our freshwater fish. It's amazing how something so small can tell us so much. It can tell us growth rates on a daily basis, on an annual basis, on a seasonal basis. It can tell us their spawning dates. It can tell us their age. It can tell us there actually are marks on the ear bone that represent feeding. And when they transition from a larvae into an adult, these are check marks, so very distinct bands on the ear bone if they experience stress. All of the chemical information that is recorded in them, so information about the diet, so carbon and nitrogen that's recorded in the ear bone. Different water masses have different chemical signatures, so it can help us to figure out what water mass they might have lived in and been transported on. They're just fascinating. The shape of them can tell us about if there are different stocks and different subpopulations in the country. Yeah, they're fascinating. I'm an otolith nerd.
Thanks, Emma. Emma Egan is a freshwater ecologist at NIWA. Kei te whakaronga mai koe ki tō tātou au horihori ki te reo erirangi o Aotearoa. I'm Alison Balance and you're with Our Changing World. Now, let's catch up with what kākāpō are up to. It turns out that the giant flightless night parrots, all 147 of them, have been very busy. The kākāpō recovery team at the Department of Conservation has known for several years that the summer of 2019 was going to be a kākāpō breeding season. For the last year, the team has also known that the first breeding season since 2016 is going to be a big one, possibly the best ever. The team was also confident of their predictions that breeding would kick off in late January. But on that count, at least, it turns out they were wrong. The birds had other ideas. I've been covering the kākāpō breeding season in a new RNZ podcast called The Kākāpō Files. And this is what kākāpō recovery team manager Deirdre Verko had to say in episode 2 of the podcast back on the 22nd of December.
So Christmas has come a bit early for the kākāpō team. Obviously we're expecting kākāpō to breed this summer and we've been quite excited about that, but we weren't really expecting an early season, and we've now had the first matings. So a female named Pearl has mated with a male named Boss two times over the last few nights. So yeah, it's put us in a bit of a spin and it's a bit of a record breaker.
Pearl and Boss, the earliest kākāpō to ever mate, are on Whenuahou Codfish Island, near Stewart Island. It's one of three kākāpō islands. The others are Anchor Island in Fiordland's Dusky Sound and Hauturu Little Barrier Island in the Hauraki Gulf. The kākāpō on Anchor Island wasted no time in getting in on the mating action. They got down to business on Christmas Eve. Here's kākāpō ranger Brodie Philp from episode 4 of the Kākāpō Files, which went to air on the 10th of January. He had just come off a month working on Anchor Island.
Yeah, we had an extremely busy period. We've now had 19 of our 21 breeding age females mate, and that's all been within the last 2.5 weeks.
Wow, that's pretty intense.
Yes, very, very, very intense, very busy, but very exciting.
The kākāpō on Whenuahou started mating a few days later, and the majority of them have now mated. Pearl, as the first kākāpō off the rank, was the first female to nest. Kākāpō are solo mums and lay usually 3, sometimes 4 eggs. Here's Daryl Eason, long-time technical officer for the kakapo program, who knows every kakapo intimately, talking about where female kakapo nest.
So it's usually in a cavity of some sort. They love hollow logs or hollows under root masses, just natural cavities, especially rata trees and totara, provide good holes. Or it might sometimes just be under a dense grass tussock type thing like a garnia, or just in a hole, a natural hole beside a rock or something like that. Usually good cover.
The kakapo team keep a close eye on what the birds are up to using a range of smart technologies. They also search out every nest and put it under close surveillance.
We'll put a camera in and a sensor across the entrance. So the sensor is just a beam and a reflector either side of the entrance. So they might have a look at that once or twice and then just ignore it.
Gosh, they're tolerant, aren't they?
They're incredibly tolerant. So we're really fortunate that you can really just do all sorts of work with and around them, and they are very accepting. They don't like the eggs being moved to a different location. So, I mean, you can pull the eggs in and out and check them, and that's fine, but they like them to be put back where they had them.
So far, there are 18 kakapo nests on Anchor Island, and the team has found 8 nests on Whenuahou. Pearl, of course, was the first to nest, but unfortunately, her first nest came to a sad end. A petrel, one of many seabirds also breeding on the island, entered the nest cavity, and while defending her 3 eggs, Pearl accidentally broke one. The other 2 turned out to be infertile, which is, unfortunately, a common problem. About half of all kakapo eggs are infertile. Knowing this has given the kakapo team confidence to take a new, bold course of action. Here's manager Deirdre Veko again.
We've been discussing for a while the idea of re-nesting some of our kakapo. With the early nesting this year, they've really handed us an opportunity to basically remove eggs from nests, shut the nest down, and encourage the females to go back and mate a second time and lay a second clutch. It's a pretty amazing opportunity. We have done it in the past. We've re-nested 12 kakapo in the past, and 8 of them went on to mate and lay eggs again. So it's an opportunity to get more than we bargained for this year.
Fantastic. And why are you going to do that?
It's really around productivity and increasing growth. So we know that we can hand-rear kakapo with no problem. So if we remove those first clutches and hand-rear the chicks, and the females do it all again, we could potentially really increase our numbers this year.
I suspect one of the reasons you're doing this is because we all know that kakapo have a problem with infertility. So more than half, is it, of eggs laid are often infertile?
Yeah, that's right. So the season starts with quite a lot of excitement at all these eggs being laid, but it steadily becomes a bit sober at times when a lot of them are infertile. So we're seeing the same thing again this year, particularly on Anchor, where we know a little bit more about our egg details. We've got about a 50% or slightly less fertility rate again this year. So there are very few kakapo, they breed so infrequently, and then we get this infertility on top of that. So anything we can do to increase potential productivity is really worth a stab at.
This bold re-nesting plan is already working. Pearl's nest was closed down after her eggs were found to be infertile. She has already mated again, and she's laid her first egg in a second nest. At the moment, the kakapo rangers are busy finding nests and bringing fertile eggs into incubators for hand-rearing. And the kakapo are variously busy booming, mating and laying eggs. Now that's all we've time for this week, but from next week I'll be regularly bringing you the latest episode of the Kakapo Files as part of Our Changing World. If you'd like more background and want to find out in detail what has happened so far, then check out the Kakapo Files, rnz.co.nz/kakapo. Or you can simply find all the episodes on the Our Changing World webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. Don't forget, you can also subscribe to Our Changing World and to the Kakapo Files as podcasts at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the usual podcast places. Stay in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook, where we are RNZ Science. Thanks for listening. But for now, it's good night from me, Alison Balance, Paul Marie.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.